This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 10101. Lecture 8, delivered on the 12th of February of 2009. The title of this lecture is Global Trade and Trade Policy.
Today, Global Trade and Trade Policy. Before I address that topic, which I shall address only insofar as comparative and absolute advantage are concerned, and then invite you to read the rest of the chapter, I need to touch back on one last subject in the previous chapter. We don't do chapter 6 in this course, so this was from chapter 5. Let me show you. When I was... Bear with me here. When I was talking about consumer choice, and really consumer choice is king in any free or semi-free society. We have a dedication to allowing consumers to make choices with the assumption that they are rational. They won't do things that are completely stupid. And the best way to give consumers the widest range of choices is to allow consumers to have property rights, to recognize as a rock-solid rule of law that what is yours, what is mine. That means that if we trade, there is no compulsion for us to trade. We would do so only if it was to our mutual advantage. Because what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours. You can't take it from me. I can't take yours from you. So if we trade, it would have to be to make both of us better. In economic fancy terminology, which I'll mention a little later again. We would say that we would execute only Pareto superior moves in a free market. We don't do things that are not to our advantage. You might say, well, I was made to do this. Well, really? Well, was a gun put here? No, but economic circumstances. Never mind that. You had free choice. And that's where property rights come into play. Recognizing your rights, recognizing your rights to your land, to your buildings, to your work ability, your muscles and your mind, and indeed, finally, to your very body. No, the government can't tell us what we do, except to maintain the civil order. But aside from that, the government should stay out of these to the extent possible. Because I guarantee you that if the government thinks it knows better than you what to do with you and what is yours, then the incentive pattern has changed and transactions no longer occur for the mutual benefit of the two people transacting. The government benefits, not the two people, the two parties who were the transactors. Well, that's my advertisement for the day for free markets. Don't get me wrong. There is a reasonable role for the government, as I said, to maintain the civil order and to advance public policy that is parsimonious. In other words, not wide-ranging. But aside from that, when the government just simply takes people's land, tells them what they have to do for their living and all of that, that's not a free market. It's certainly not going to give people their greatest incentive. wonderful jokes occur from the old Soviet Union. And it really is beginning to trouble me because I'm talking about an empire that existed before a lot of you can remember. How many of you remember the Soviet Union? I miss it. The spy novels were so much better. You know, the spy movies. I mean, James Bond. Back in those days, he dealt with communist spies. Shaken, not stirred. Now we've got a James Bond. Who else can I kill? aside from that. There were so many jokes in the Soviet era because the government decided it was a centrally planned economy. One of the command economies that I told you about. The government decided what you did for a living. The government decided how resources were allocated. And you had all the, just so many jokes from that era. There was the one, the Soviet workers would say, well, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. The Soviet era was an era when the people in that country were miserable. Their manufacturing was rather bad, to the extent that I believe there was a communist regime that one of the communist regimes in Eastern Europe produced cars. And these cars were so bad, no one would buy them. Unless they had to. The jokes around, so why do they put a heating element on the back window? Oh, that's easy. That way your hands stay warm when you're pushing it. So why did you give that car a fill up with gas? Because it doubled its value. Or the famous old one. So why do the KGB agents walk in groups of three? Oh, that's simple, comrade. One reads, one writes, and the other keeps an eye on the two intellectuals. Guess you could say that about American police now. Funny how things change. But if we are in a free market, or something reasonably representing a free market, when I draw supply and demand curves, they genuinely represent free choices on the demand side, free choices by consumers to buy or not buy products at given prices. So when I draw a demand curve downward sloping like this, I am representing in quantity and price space the willingness and ability. And not just the willingness and ability, the free willingness and unfettered ability of consumers to choose a quantity of this product given the price of it. So that's the quantity demanded concept. As the price goes up, the quantity demanded goes down, simply because people are free to find other products that are substitutes. It's a free choice decision. Now, on the other hand, when I draw a supply curve, and you'll see this later in the course, the suppliers live in a world of factors of production that come together to produce a product. And as the price of the product goes up, the producers are free to reallocate their resources toward that product and away from other things they could make. It is a free choice. There is not a central authority that decides that you should produce this or you should produce that. If the price of the product that I have shown here on this upward sloping supply curve increases, the producer has the freedom to move factors of production from other goods and services to this one because it is relatively more costly to use those factors of production to produce something else. So there is a freedom of choice on the supply side, just like there's a freedom of choice on the demand side. And we put those together, and we get, let me ask, when I put a supply curve and a demand curve together, what is it I have drawn there? What is it? Oh, I love it when you talk like that. Yes, it's a market. I think I'll need to go home and bathe. Yes, excellent. Now, these sound like trivial points, but they are not. And especially for what I'm about to point out here, the concepts of producer and consumer surplus. They have everything to do with the free choice that is going on. Look, this place right here, what we call the equilibrium price, the market clearing price, that is the place where the quantity being supplied to the market is cleared by the quantity being demanded by the market. It is a place that the demanders choose to be. It's a free choice. That price, like every price, is a price that can be, you can buy the product at the price or not buy it at the price. The suppliers similarly could be at any, could see any price, and they would be free to decide whether to deliver the product to the market or not. But there's something kind of special about this price right here, other than the fact that it is that sweet spot where what is on the shelves is cleared by how much is wanted from the shelves. That's an excellent place to be anyway. But there's something else about it too, interestingly enough. You see? Let me try this. Let me do it this way. How much is a glass of water out of the sink, out of the spigot at the sink? How much is it? Oh, virtually not. I mean, maybe a penny. I mean, a penny. We say, you know. Someone's saying, hell, my mom and dad pay the bill. Well, actually, a lot of people don't even pay for water. You know, it's like included in the rent, but you are paying for it. You just don't see it. But, okay, now suppose that I said, well, I'm afraid that glass of water is going to, instead of costing you less than a penny, it's going to cost you 5 cents. Now, if you're thirsty, you're still going to buy 5 cents. Let's try this one. You remember when the price of gasoline went up to something like stupid 09? Did you just say, no, I'm not going to pay anymore? I'm not going to pay. I'll drive my car without gas. You still paid the damn price for it. And then, did you notice when the price went down, it got down there to like $1.54 there for a while? Oh, happy days, dancing in the streets. Yeah, that was just wonderful. But you see, I knew already that you would pay $4.09 for gas. The fact that when the gas price went back down, you paid less, that was sort of like a bonus to you. Let me try this. Have you ever gone to class nude? I mean, you'd probably be willing to pay, even for that kind of a shirt, you know, at least $10, $20, okay, $2 for that shirt. You'd pay more for something to wear than what you have to. You really would. So, let me take it back to this. Suppose that, you, sir, you'd never had sex in your life, and you're a 50-year-old guy. You'd pay. Sure you would. Don't tell me no, I wouldn't. I'll just stay there reading my Bible. No, you... You'd pay, dude. So, and I do not want to be gross here, son, if you get it for free, you've gotten a bonus. Not that you will, but I mean, speculatively, sure. You see, you're getting surplus. Every time you pay less for something than you would actually will be willing to pay, I mean, you're getting a bonus. You're getting a surplus. And you show that. When prices go up, you bitch, but you still buy some of it. So when the price goes down, you are actually showing that you would have been willing to pay more, possibly able to pay more, but you don't have to. So I want you to look right here. See this place right here. At this price, high price, above equilibrium, there would still be quantity demanded for that product. It's still there. There's still quantity demanded at that high price. I want you to look at it. Let's zoom in on it, okay? We're going to magnify that right there. You see that? That's your ass! And your ass would have paid! Now, granted, it would have been out the ass, but you would have paid a price. Someone would have, you would have, we're just using you as an example. It might not have been you, but it might have been you. It might have been you. Someone would have paid. If I draw the demand curve there, that must represent that some demand existed there. So what I am trying to point out here is that all of these people up through here, you see all these people right here? They got surplus. They would have paid more, but the market did not require them to. You would pay more for water. You would pay more for gasoline. You would pay more for food. You would pay more for ass. But you don't have to because the price at equilibrium is below that. Now, there are sorry losers down here who are out of the market. No question about that. But all of these people up here are earning what we call consumer surplus. They are people who would have been willing to pay these higher prices. And this area, literally right here, is the value that they are getting by paying the equilibrium price instead of the price that would have been higher. Now, I want to point this out strongly because in a free market, you are free to choose not to buy the product at any given price. But there's another side to that freedom. You are free to pay a lower price than you would have been willing and able to pay. That's the great side of freedom. The downside is you are free not to buy something. But at the same time, you are also free to pay prices that are a lot lower than what you would have actually been willing to pay. If you think about it, so many of these things out there, it would hurt like hell if you had to pay more, but the competitive market keeps the prices from going stupid high, way out of control. I'll give you a funny example. Is anyone familiar with the story, the recent story of a country called Zimbabwe? Is it Zimbabwe? Yes. They had this ridiculously crazy dictator there. He'd gotten worse and worse as years went on. Inflation got insanely high. And his way of handling it was he simply said any producer who tries to raise his prices will be shot or something like that. Of course, that never works. Price controls never work, as you've already seen. That's price ceilings. But it's gotten to the point where recently they've had to reissue their currency. And to give you an idea of how bad the prices are there now, their most recent issue of currency, the base note is $1 billion note. That's sort of like a penny. It's probably qualifies as one of the highest inflation rates in history. But you see, in a place like that where the people are not allowed to raise their wages, you really have no freedom left. You are in a really bad place there. Now, on the other side, look at these producers. Key on one of these guys right here. See this producer right here? He would have been willing to deliver some quantity to the market, a quantity supplied, at a price down there, below equilibrium. If I draw the supply curve there, some producers are there who would have been able to push into the market some product. The fact that they don't have to do that, the fact that they can charge up here, means that they are getting a surplus. There are producers who are extraordinarily efficient. They would not have to charge more than this price to get some of their product out into the market. But they don't have to charge that low price. They can charge the equilibrium price up here. So all of these producers, this part thing right here that I am drawing, is what we call producer surplus. It's just the area from equilibrium down to the supply curve. Just like the consumer surplus is the area from the equilibrium up to the demand curve. And these are aspects of a free market. I could actually, this would be like a little bit maybe more college prep kind of, maybe an early college level math course. I could show you a theorem. It's sort of like a geometry theorem, that there is no other price that would maximize the area of these two taken together. If I chose a price up here, notice how my producer surplus would be bigger, but my consumer surplus would be smaller. If I took a price down here and tried to impose a price down here, well, that would mean the consumer surplus would be bigger, but the producer surplus would be smaller. And again, it's one of those geometry proofs I could show you. Actually, it's kind of like an algebra/geometry proof that the largest area is where this breakoff line is at the equilibrium point, the intersection of the two. The largest summative area of CS and PS there is where you see it. If I were, and again, just to try not to be obtuse about that, if I were to draw this again, but this time I were to say I'm going to impose this price instead of the equilibrium price, this area would be much smaller, this area would be much larger, but interestingly enough, geometrically and algebraically, I could show you that that total area is actually not as big as that area. And that might seem counterintuitive, but that's how it would work, interestingly enough. Now, later in the course, in just a little while, we go from the theory of the consumer to the theory of the firm. And I'll show you what's an industry structure called monopoly. Monopolies, one of the worst things about monopolies is that they actually have an equilibrium price, a profit maximizing price, that is different from free market equilibrium in a competitive market. And that's a rather odd thing, that you have an actual kind of market that exists or close to exists out there that robs the society of some of its total surplus. And that's a very good argument for stopping monopolies from forming, a good argument for public policy intervention. Unfortunately, public policy has largely fallen completely down. It fell down with Microsoft. It's fallen down with the telecoms. It's falling down with Google. It's falling down with a lot of companies that are growing and growing. We know economically that these are actually detrimental to the society in terms of the surplus, total surplus, but our politicians are way too afraid of these entities to deal with them effectively and to bust them up. Because the last time a breakup was tried, it failed miserably. That was the breakup of the AT&T in the 80s. But instead of learning how to do it right, our politicians have decided not to do it at all. Now, I want to bring up one more little point right there. I've got a producer down here who's charging a low price. Now, in a competitive market, we assume that there are many, many, many buyers and many, many sellers, and there is more or less a ubiquitous product and all of that kind of stuff. The question would come up, well, if that producer can sell at that low price, why would he sell at the higher price? I mean, if I have lower costs, what would be to keep me from just passing those along? Why would I raise my price to what everyone else is charging? I could charge less. Well, the first thing is, remember that there are plenty of consumers for everybody. So he's not like he's stealing customers. He's just, he might be getting more customers, but there's a large universe of customers out there. Here's the point, though. Let's try it this way. And this is very important because you get a lot of common people, political pundits, especially liberals, it seems, are very much bothered by jacking up your price just because you can. Why? This is greed, jacking up your price just because you can. Okay. Let me show you why that's not greed. Suppose that you are a gas station owner, small, independent, and you have just bought a 20,000 gallon load of gasoline and you paid $2 for that load of gasoline. And you mark it up a little bit, let's say to $2.25, so you can pull a profit of 25 cents a gallon on 20,000 gallons. So you are going to pull $5,000 off this load of gasoline. Now, just after you get your load of gasoline and you post your prices, you're back in your station, sitting there waiting for your loving customers to come around. And you look out the window and you see that everyone else is posting around your same price. A couple of them might call you, I'm at $2.25 today. Okay, so am I. No, that's not collusion. That's very normal communication. You could just look out your window and see the same thing. And so everyone's around $2.25, the gas station's in your area. And then you're sitting in there watching your little black and white sad TV with the rabbit ears on it. And you see all of a sudden that there was an attack on Iran, and Iran has mined the Strait of Hormuz. The price of gasoline on the price of oil on the high seas just went through the roof in the futures markets, and you call up your distributor, and he says, well, your next load of gasoline is going to cost you $10 a gallon. Why are you going to immediately jack your price up to $10.25 a gallon? You bought it at $2.25. You're just ripping off these poor consumers. You're taking advantage. Why are you going to put your price to $10.25 if it's not greed?
To make those 20,000 gallons less as long as possible.
No. Replacement cost. What's your next load of gasoline going to cost you? Yeah, $10. You sell it at $2.25 a gallon, that's your ass. You won't have the money for your next load. You don't price based on historical cost. You price based on replacement cost. Because you are going to have to buy that next load of gasoline if you want to stay in business. And here's the other thing. You suppose that you, no, I'm going to keep mine at $2.25. That's the way I was raised. You look out there and all your competitors have gone up to $10.25. Well, the customers obviously are going to come to your station, right? They're going to wipe out your load, and once they have finished wiping out your 20,000 gallons, what are they going to do? They're going to go to your competitors. And then they will fondly remember that gas station that was there, that's now a parking lot hole, with a creepy guy who's still sitting there pretending he's watching his black and white TV. Do you see why it's not greed? It is rational business decision making that is involved here. Yes, sure, you got your load at $2.25, $2. You ain't going to get your next load there, so you better make sure that you've earned enough to pay for the next load. Or you don't have a business. Okay? That's why that producer will be there. You charge what the market will bear. You don't charge based upon your love of your customers. For God's sake, those customers aren't going to care rat's ass about you once you're gone. They'll just go to the competitors who were there screwing them. And if you don't, if you like that hardcore mean lecture, you'll hear it again if you take my business courses over at the university. This isn't liberal and conservative. This is just business, and it really is painful in a way. You do have to jack up your price, but at the same time, you've got to stay alive in business. If you really do love your customer, you don't love your customer by destroying your own company and letting the vultures take over the industry. You move with the vultures, but you find your possible opportunities to do a little bit better for the world than the vultures do. That's how it works. Enough of that bitching lecture. Now, trade and global trade and trade policy and all of that. I don't delve into it terribly deeply in a micro course, but as I said, I do actually favor addressing this macro topic in micro just long enough to get you used to it so that when you do hit it again in macro, it's not a totally new story to you. Similarly, in this course, I will treat the theory and pricing and practice of pricing bonds, which is traditionally done in a macro course, even though that's truly a micro subject. But it makes my life easier in macro if you know how to do that here and from your micro course. But as far as trade theory goes and trade, all of that, have any of you ever been to other countries? Where have you been?
Canada.
Well, that's a really sort of another country, but Canada, it just reminds me so much. Canada is just sort of the United States, except it's colder. I shouldn't say it. It is politically quite a bit different, but it's like being in another part of the United States to a certain extent. In a lot of parts of the world, you go to these places, and I can attest to this, things are way different. I mean, it's just like, it's like another world. I was in a country where the tour guide, very, very nice. Oh, he wasn't a tour guide. He was sort of like the person watching over me and making sure that I didn't get mugged in an alley and all that kind of stuff. You know, it was to the point where we went into this place and I needed to go to the bathroom, and he pointed to this room. I went in there and I looked in, and it wasn't a bathroom. There was a hole in the friggin' ground, a wood hole, and there was a pitcher of water. And I just yell out, "What do I do in here?" And of course, this smart ass, he said, "You take a shit." No, man, there's no toilet. What the hell are you? The toilet is there in the ground. You see, that's the way other parts of the world are. They are extraordinarily different from ours. You drive through some countries and you actually begin to miss pollution. You miss seeing factories. I mean, it's just farm, cow, farm, corn, farm, cow. There is no civilization. Where do you keep your shopping malls? What are those? Oh man, you are behind the times. Yeah. Literally parts of the world. And it's not that they are less than ours. It's just that they are very different from ours. And in some places, it's just amazing the number of people. I mean, it's just like swarming human masses of humanity. Just bumping up against it. It's not even New York City. New York City, you know, at least when you're in New York City, you can grope people, you know. But in these countries, everyone's ugly. No, I shouldn't say that. But just very different places. Lack of machines. You don't see the machines. And when you see the machines, they're not the same as ours. So many people, and so many poor people, too. Just God. And the world is different in different places. And it has not a uniform allocation of resources across the planet. In our country, in the United States, we are huge and we have a lot of land. And we also have a lot of mineral resources too. Incredible numbers of mineral resources. And we have very, very cool waterway systems. Who could have hoped for something better than a massive river right down the middle of the country? That's just awesome. And these big, huge lakes that you can move stuff from one place to another along those lakes. Just incredible stuff we have here. And we also have the benefit of, even though we constantly bitch, we have the benefit of being quite attractive to people from all over the world. So we can get not just the best of the best, but we can also get the hardest working of the people of the world who are so hard working that they're willing to risk their lives to come here. But the rest of the world isn't like that. Different countries have different sets of resources. There are some countries that are rich in minerals. Some countries are rich in just raw labor. Some countries are rich in other things. And some countries are just bigger than other countries. I've been in countries where it was literally, I was cut through the country in a couple of hour drive. And here, I can't cut through this country. Well, I stop anyway. If there's a Waffle House, I pull off. You know, is there a Waffle House anywhere in this state? Do you know what a Waffle House is? If you're drunk and you're too drunk to read White Castle signs, you know the Waffle House is yellow. Yeah, is there a Waffle House anywhere around here? Oh man, I could make a fortune. Put up a White Castle on one side of this town, put up a Waffle House on the other side, put a strip joint. Anyway. Sorry, my entrepreneurial spirit is coming back out there again. Absolute advantage. A country can produce more in total amount than another country. That's absolute advantage. The United States has absolute advantage in lots of things. We can just outproduce the world. Now here's the other one, comparative advantage. A country has comparative advantage if it can produce, a product more cheaply than another country. Let me show you what this means in practice. What this actually means in practice. I want to check the book to make sure that this is related to something you'll read in the book called the Heckscher-Ohlin theorem. And I'll show you what that means. You don't have to do any math for it, but I'm going to show you a little bit of a sort of an arithmetic exercise here with two countries. And I'll do it with just two products. These two countries both can produce these products. Country A and country B, I will write across a row at the top, and along the side in a column, I'm going to write steel and corn. The two countries can each produce steel and or corn. And we'll hold them at the end points here. And country A, if it used all of its resources to produce steel, it could produce 1,200 tons of steel. If, however, it pushed all of its resources into corn, it could produce 600 tons of corn. Okay, now let's look at country B. Country B can produce 400 tons of steel, or it can produce, if it put all of its resources into steel, it could produce 400 tons of steel, or it could produce 100 tons of corn if it put all of its resources into corn. Now, it's funny because I teach these business courses over at the university, and a lot of those people haven't had economics. And there is actually something I'm going to do here has a huge implication in management of a company. But I can't tell them all the story of how this is an economics concept that is applies to the global trade as well as to managerial decision making, like I could you on the other side. I can tell you the management side of this in a minute, but I can't tell them the economic side because they just stare at me. We ain't had economics yet. But let me show you what's going on here. I want you to look at this in terms of opportunity cost. You see, the opportunity cost of 1,200 tons of steel for country A is 600 tons of corn. In order to produce the 1,200 tons of steel, they would have to give up 600 tons of corn. And for country B, the opportunity cost of producing 400 tons of steel is 100 tons of corn that they'd have to give up to do it. Okay, but so I bring that up. Notice in this example that country A has absolute advantage in both steel and corn. That's why I'm doing it like this, so that you can see this is absolute advantage. They can produce, and country A can produce absolutely more steel, 1,200 to 400, and it can produce absolutely more corn, 600 to 100. So that in a sense you would say, well, why doesn't country A just take care of itself? Yeah, obviously, it's an 800-pound gorilla. Oh, well, let's, again, go back and look at opportunity cost in each country. Now, what I'm going to do right here is I'm going to say 1,200 steel equals 600 corn. That is the trade-off equation. You see that? And I could write it the other way, too. And you're going to say, why the hell are you doing this? I could write it as 600 corn tons of corn equals 1,200 tons of steel. And again, you're saying, well, why would you do it both ways? It's just so I don't have the aggravation of doing a reciprocal here in a minute. Well, let me do this. That would mean that one steel costs 0.5 corn. Do you see how I did that? I just divide both sides. And so I'm getting it down so that I can say one steel is what? And writing it the other way, I could say, okay, one corn is two steels. And I'm just writing the same thing the other way. And that's why I wrote it the two ways, just so you can see it. I could have just technically taken the first equation there and flipped it over. But I just write it both ways for you, okay? So I can say, well, how much corn would one steel buy? It'd buy 0.5 of corn. Well, how much steel would one corn buy? It'd buy two steels. Now let me look at it on country B, and let me do the same thing. I'm going to say 400 steels equals 100 corns, or putting it the other way, 100 corns equals 400 steels. And you don't have to do it this pedantically. You could, some of you at least, I'm sure, could do it faster without writing both ways. But what I'm going to do here is, just like on the other side, I'm going to say, okay, one steel costs me 0.25 corn from the first one and in country B. And putting it the other way, I could say that one corn equals four steels. Okay, you with me on that? And just do this, just like mechanical. Don't think about it. Just, you can do this mechanically. Here's where you think about what's going on. I want you to look at what these four little side things, two for each country, have just told us. In country A, how much does it cost to make one steel? In country A, how much does it cost to make one steel in country A?
0.5 corn.
Yeah, 0.5 corn. Now, how much in country B does it cost to make one steel?
0.25 corn.
Oh my, country B can produce steel more cheaply. Now let's look at the other one. Now let me try this with you. In country A, how much does it cost to make one corn? In country B, how much does it cost to make one corn? So in which country is it cheaper to make corn? Well, spank me hard and call me Doris. Country B has the comparative advantage in steel, and country A has the comparative advantage in corn. Because in country B, it costs, for to make steel, it costs only 0.25 corn. In country A, it costs 0.5 corn. It's twice as expensive in country A to make steel. On the other hand, in country A, it costs two steels to make a corn, but in country B, it costs four steels to make a corn. So, it costs twice as much in country B to make corn as it does in country A. Well, isn't that interesting? You see, do you see how huge country A is? Country A can make 1,200 tons of steel. Why do they make steel? Because it actually costs them more comparatively than it does in country B. If these two countries are freely trading and they are rational, then country B would specialize in making steel, country A would specialize in making corn, and then they trade them and move towards their relative efficiencies. Now that doesn't mean, probably in this case, country A would have, might have a larger demand overall, so it would still probably have to make some steel, because it couldn't buy all of its steel from country B, but it sure as hell would move toward production of corn, because it's more efficient to not make corn, to just buy it from a country, to not make steel, because it's cheaper to buy the steel from another country that does it more cheaply. And if both of the countries are willing to do this, move toward their specializations, and then trade with each other, the world benefits because resources are being used more efficiently in both countries. That is the power of global trade. Countries moving toward not absolute advantage, but toward comparative advantage. Again, countries are not efficient moving towards their absolute advantage. They're efficient moving toward their comparative advantage. So even though a country like the United States can make more of everything than any country on earth, quite literally we could, it is inefficient for us to, because there are other places where some of those things can be made more cheaply. Now, that's taking away all I said at the beginning about how countries can cheat their way. And it's really those countries that cheat on their exchange rates and all of that. And forgive me for bringing back the example of China. China in the 1990s, we're going to go to a free market economy. And all of these neoliberals and neoconservatives in the United States, ooh, they're going to become like us. No, they weren't. They still don't get it. The Chinese don't get it. Free trade means trusting the market to move you towards your efficient production schedule. The lesson here in management is this. There are people, and you'll see these people in group work in college. You'll see them in the work environment. Oh, Lord, I can do all of this. I can type faster than everyone. I can research better. I can do Excel. So I'll just do it all. All of you go to hell. I'll just take care of it all. Do you see how inefficient that is to do that? You very well might type faster and do research faster. But that does not mean you have the comparative advantage in both of them. You see, just because you have one hotshot worker who can do everything does not mean that you give everything to the hotshot worker. Just because you have one person who says, I can do everything better, and you actually, he might very well be able to, you don't let him do everything because he has comparative advantage in only one thing. And that's why you move. Even someone who might be a slower typist than you might actually have a comparative advantage in typing to you in a company. And that is a powerful lesson in management. It's too far too often managers just try to find the person who can do everything or the person who can do everything, all the different aspects the fastest. And that is an incredible waste of resources because it doesn't matter who can do everything the most. What matters is who can do each thing the most efficiently in a comparative sense. And I try to talk about this in management, but without the idea of comparative advantage in there and showing an example like this, it doesn't work too well. But it's a crucial concept in managerial excellence is not finding what is the biggest in one person. It's finding what is the best in every person. And that's a lesson that you would get from me in a course in management, a business course. But there's the kind of the lesson from this is, and here what I'm going to do, I'm going to take this off the board, and for the weekend, just give you one quick problem. I'm just going to take this off and replace these numbers with some other numbers just to give you a shot at doing one of these. And it's just kind of a monkey see, monkey do. If you got it in your notes, you'll have no problem with it. But software and hardware for a computer. Country A can make 200 units of software if it used all of its resources for software, or it can make 500 units of hardware. Country B can make 100 units of software if it uses all of its resources for software, or it can make 200 units of hardware if it uses all of its resources. Who has comparative advantage? Absolute advantage is too easy. I'm not going to ask you that. Well, actually, on a quiz, just for a free point, I might say, who has absolute advantage in both products? But here's the question is, which country should produce what based upon comparative advantage principle? Just write it down. It's just a quick, dirty problem. While you're doing other things, I don't expect you to do anything but economics when you're on your weekends. So,
or possibly not. Okay. But it shouldn't take you more than a minute or two to do this problem. And it gives you an idea. This isn't hard stuff. And it's such an important lesson, but it's not hard to learn it and hard to see it in practice. And that is all I have for you today. I thank you.